House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Colleagues and to the public, I want to let it be noted that we need an additional amendment on House Bill 2519. So we're going to carry that one over until Wednesday at 9 o'clock, and we'll post a new agenda for that. And we will... Brewer's not here yet, so...
She will not be coming. She notified me she's ill this morning.
Ah, okay.
Sorry.
Do you want to try to work the bill that she's prepared?
Have we heard that bill? I don't think we've even heard that.
No, we did hear it earlier, but...
Not the amendment.
So we need to...
I think we better wait. On which bill is that? 3454.
I would like to hear the amendment.
You want to hear it today?
Yeah, I'd like to hear the amendment.
All right.
We don't have to move the bill.
What I was worried about was, okay, we'll open the public hearing on House Bill 3454.
Could we have a fiscal on this?
Let's hear from Chris.
Yeah.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3454, there's a dash 2 amendment, and you do have all the paperwork for it, a revenue impact and a fiscal impact statement. But first, what the amendment does, it's a gut and stuff, and it deals with an intersection of Oregon law dealing with net operating losses on personal income tax returns and our disconnect from federal law. For example, from the bonus depreciation. As you recall from the bonus depreciation, the way that worked, it was a timing in which and when that deduction was claimed, and in the first year, there was an addition to Oregon taxable income to compensate for the amount of the bonus depreciation. And then in subsequent years, there was a subtraction allowed on the tax return for every year, so that by the end of the life of the property, the deduction was the same at the federal. It was all just a timing issue. Well, for some taxpayers, in the year that they claimed the bonus depreciation, if they were in a net operating loss position at the federal level, Oregon also defines net operating loss as whatever net operating loss is for the feds. So at the federal level, they would calculate their taxes, they would claim the bonus depreciation, and they would be put into a net loss position. And then on the Oregon return, the definition was the net operating loss, same as the federal. So in effect, they utilized the bonus depreciation in that year because of the loss position that they were in. Well, in subsequent years, they were allowed a subtraction for a difference in depreciation. So in a sense, that can be described as a double dipping or double deduction situation where they benefited from the bonus depreciation in the first year because of their net operating loss position. And then in every subsequent year, every time they claimed this subtraction, there was an extra deduction they had already benefited from. So what the dash 2 does is disallows that subtraction in each of these subsequent years. And so that's why the revenue impact reflects a gain in revenue. And there is a kind of a doubling up. We were disconnected for tax year 2009 and 2010. So 2009, you'd have a taxpayer who was in a loss position at the federal level, and they had that situation, and their loss was applied to Oregon. And so via that, they benefited from the bonus depreciation. Now, starting in tax year 2010, they were allowed a subtraction, and then for 11 and 12 for the useful life of the property. So what I was able to do was work with the Department of Revenue and look at 2009 tax returns that had a net operating loss and match those with 2010 returns that we have to date, those taxpayers who claim that deduction, and to try and hone in on how many taxpayers there are and what the size of this, the impact would be. And through that, we're linking 2009 returns to the 2010 returns, got a number of returns that fit into this category that were in net operating loss in 2009 and claimed a subtraction in Oregon for a difference in depreciation. And that was the basis for the revenue impact. And then we had that same situation in 10 going forward. In 2010, there will be taxpayers who are in a loss position, in part because of bonus depreciation at the federal level. Mm-hmm. And again, there'll be a loss at the state level. And so in 2011, they'll first be claiming that subtraction. So what the, in terms of getting this, correcting this double dipping, what the Section 3 of the amendment does is that certain taxpayers are certainly allowed to file an amended return, but what Section 3 does was is say that you don't have to file an amended return, you can just add this income back on your 2011 return rather than having to go through the process of filing an amended return. And so that's why the revenue impact in the first biennium, 11-13, is about $800,000. Because you have 2 years for the 09 bonus depreciation, there'll be the add back for 2010 and 2011. And then for the bonus depreciation claimed in 2010, there's the first year of the add back, 2011. So that's why it's 800,000. And then it'll decline because depreciation, that's how depreciation works. It's an accelerated kind of thing where over time, less of that depreciation occurs. So the subtraction should also decline over time.
It's just a truing up.
And so that's the essence of the Dash 2 and the revenue impact, and there is no fiscal impact.
And is this a revenue-raising bill, or is it a technical fix bill that clarifies existing law?
A technical fix.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Yes.
Oh, we're in public hearing.
Yeah. I'm comfortable with this bill, I think. Representative Brewer, unfortunately, was ill. She signaled me this morning. This is her bill. I think she wants it. And I think, being the timing that it is...
Is there anyone who wants to be heard on House Bill 3454? I think that means that you and Revenue are in agreement about it.
Nobody had signed up, and it's my understanding that Representative Brewer and the department worked directly in crafting the amendment.
And I'm getting head nods all around. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3454 and open the work session on House Bill 3454.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3454.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 2 amendments to the 3454 discussion. Any objections to the motion? Motion carries. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3454 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 3454 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections to the motion? No objections. The motion carries. Representative Brewer will ask to carry the bill. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3454. Okay, we have another one up here. 123653. Christine's on. Okay. Nobody signed up yet. So it's just a question. There's a fiscal of about $300,000.
Right.
So there's a question that they've sent. All right. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2653. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2653, you heard there was a public hearing on it last week. This is the bill that would allow justice courts to assign certain collection activities to the Department of Revenue, and if they submit an annual report to the Legislative Fiscal Office. You do have the paperwork for it. There's a fiscal impact and a revenue impact. The fiscal impact does reflect a biennial cost of $300,000, depending on how many FTE would be hired by the Department of Revenue to handle the additional work. And the fiscal impact on LFO for any reporting is indeterminate. You also have a preliminary revenue impact that right now indicates no revenue impact, and I'm going to change it to indeterminate. Just to clarify, and the revenue impact would depend on a number of factors. It would depend on the funding that the Department of Revenue got for the positions to deal with the additional collections, as well as how many justice courts would actually send collectible accounts to the Department of Revenue and the size of those accounts.
Right.
So rather than no impact, a better descriptor would be an indeterminate revenue impact.
Right. Now, as I recall, the fiscal impact is related to expenses for the collections, and that it would be paid for out of the receipts.
I believe that's the intent.
Right.
And the fiscal does describe, the assumption there is that they would, that all 41 courts would be sending collection activity to the department.
We don't really expect that, do we?
There is the possibility that that would not be the case.
Okay. All right. Could we hear from Revenue and Mr. Kyler? Mr. Kyler wants to give us some information that, to confirm some information that came during the public hearing, and I just want to make sure that we've got our assumptions right about this. Any fiscal is other revenue, and the revenue is related, I'm sorry, the fiscal is covered by other revenue, and the fiscal is directly related to the cost of collection. Have I got that right?
Chair Barnhart, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Yes, Mr. Chair, the cost to collect an account is recovered from the agency or the entity that assigns the debt. We would have some setup costs because of the moving this to a full collection function, but eventually the cost should be recovered through collection of the debt from the agency.
Okay. Do we know how much the setup costs are likely to be? Is that what the $300,000 is, or is it something else?
Mr. Chair, I think the primary component in the $300,000 is the hiring of four additional revenue agents to collect the debt. Which, as you indicate, would be eventually paid through recovery of the debt and passing that cost on. So primarily what we would need, I believe, is limitation authority.
Right.
Understanding that I'm not at all a budget person.
Right. No, I understand.
Thank you.
Do you expect that the setup costs would be covered, recovered during the biennium or not?
Mr. Chair, I do think they probably would be recovered in the first biennium.
Is this going to Ways and Means?
It doesn't have a referral. That's why I'm asking about it. That's why I'm asking all these questions. Mr. Kyler, you had an additional point you wanted to make about information you provided during the public hearing.
Sure. Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee, Alex Kyler, Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I thought it was a very good discussion during the work session. I had handed out a chart that showed a sampling of five courts and what they currently, their current experiences with regards to their efficacy of collection, and compared that to an 80% collection rate, and that we had received from a document put out by Oregon Judicial Department for the Interim Committee on Justice System Revenue, and it showed a pie chart where they broke out the amounts imposed by case class, and then showed the collections for those amounts imposed, and that was where I got the 80% collection rate. There was a bit of emailing over the weekend, and the woman who put this together suggested that my analysis appeared correct to her, that the fines imposed during 2008 and the fines collected in 2008 were indeed from the same year. They weren't sort of some backlog. And so I just wanted to clarify that for the committee. I would, if I could, take a moment just to address the issue of demand here. I do not think we're going to see 41 justice courts knocking on DOR's door within the first even biennium. I've done some reaching out to this community. It is a disparate community of courts. But some people know about the bill, others have no idea. A lot of people do their own collections. A lot of people, like Lane County, we have our own collections and we contract with a collection agency. So again, this is another tool. Whether there's this pent-up demand of 41 courts, I would say no. We may see five or six courts, however, take advantage. Whether that has implications for the four revenue agents, I think it does, but I couldn't tell you exactly what that means for DOR.
Thank you. I assume Justice Lemhouse in Lynn County will take advantage of it because he's the one who asked for this thing in the first place.
Co-Chairs Barnhart, Berger, members of the committee, yes, in Judiciary, Mr. Lemhouse, Judge Lemhouse testified. He spoke to an issue where members of the bar may have a conflict with courts and seeing collection agencies that they contract with in their courts on various issues. So that was one of the reasons that he felt like the tool was needed, because he'd like to be able to have another agency to go to other than somebody that his court contracts with.
Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, when we look at the type of collection activity that is the most likely to result in payment of these fines, is it the offset device that is what this bill is trying to get at most likely? The reason I ask the question is most of these fines are relatively small, and pursuing them in the normal means other than just sending a letter is usually not worth it. And so thus, it must be the offset device that is what this bill is really about. Am I correct there?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, and Representative Benz, actually, justice courts already have access to the tool at DOR for offset. What they don't have access to is what is termed full collection. That's where they work with the employment department, and they actually may do wage garnishment with the employment, you know, with DOR and the employment department and other resources at the Department of Revenue. So really it's going from a sort of a limited ability to work with the Department of Revenue to accessing all the services that agency offers.
Yes, please.
Thank you for that, and that clarifies clears up what is actually going on. So we can anticipate then, as a result, this is quite a, if all of these folks assigned all of these claims to the department, we could anticipate then someone else is going to get to do some more work, and that's what I'm trying to get to. Who is that someone else? Is it the Department of Employment? Who, because the garnishment activity is not without its cost and effort. So I'm trying to anticipate what is going to actually happen. If it's not that offset, are we going to see a lot more? Is it a garnishment device that's used at the employment department? Or who's going to get to do all the work is my question.
Thank you, Chairs. Ken Ross from the Department of Revenue. Representative Benz, this work would most likely go to the Department of Revenue. So there's an automated process that we go through with our collections where we get a debt, we get it into our system, and then it generates automatic demand letters, demand for payments, and eventually, if it goes that far, it would get to the garnishment level, and there are costs associated with that for recording. Those are costs that are in this process through our other agency accounts would get passed on to the debtor eventually.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My experience with garnishments is that much of the cost is borne by the employer because they're the ones that have to actually answer the garnishment, and seldom is that money recovered from the debtor. So I'm just anxious to see how that actually is going to work out and who is doing the work. And I haven't quite heard that yet. Am I hearing that it will be the Department of Revenue that's going to be? I want to go to the garnishment part, not the demand. The demand letter is easy. I'm talking about actually collecting it. So.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Benz, the Department of Revenue would be the ones that would do the work to get it set up. Obviously, the actual honoring of the garnishment is going to be done by the employer or the financial institution, wherever the garnishment is served. So, yes, they will have costs to honor that garnishment.
Thank you.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Watt.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wanted to follow up a little bit. So refresh my memory on these fines that you're collecting on. You get to add your collection costs to the amount that's owed?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Juan, we charge a percentage of the collection of the debt. So we don't add that to the debt. So if they send us a $10 debt, we collect $10 and send $8 to the agency that sent us the money.
Yes,
yeah.
Please.
So you have to do an incredible volume of $20 amounts at a 20% rate of return in order to pencil out the time and expense of doing the garnishments or the liens or the offsets or even the demand letters. I do a little bit of this work, and how do you make money doing that?
Co-Chair Barnhart-Berger, Representative Juan, the Lane County Justice Court handles 1,700 cases a month. We've, over the last 10 years, and if you recall my testimony, we've accumulated over $10 million worth of debt. So there is, just as in state courts, this is not a problem unique to justice courts. We have an enormous amount of collections that are outstanding. Whether or not this bill is going to be the answer to all those problems, I can assure you that it is not. But it is another tool that we would have. It's a permissive bill, so the court itself gets to weigh that percentage collection that you've just heard testimony about versus doing something else, whether that's on their own or with a private collection firm. The bill is not a requirement.
Follow up, Mr. Kocher.
Yes, please.
Thank you. And that didn't drive really at the heart of my question. When we were talking in judiciary, I was concerned about the justice courts and whether they would get any money and whether it made any sense for them. Now that we're in revenue, I'm concerned with whether or not the Department of Revenue can do this in a way that the cost does not exceed the benefit in terms of the 20% that the Department of Revenue is getting. And so that's why I'm very inclined, I'm not going to ask a follow-up, just make a statement. I'm very inclined that this really ought to go to Ways and Means, and I'd be very comfortable with it going over there.
I think the line of questions leads me to the same conclusion, Representative Wanda, and I appreciate that. Let me ask one more. 41 courts, if a half a dozen of them choose to use this for a portion of their collections, you're not going to hire four people, are you?
Chair Barnhart, no, we wouldn't hire four.
Yeah, you'll hire people as you need them, rather than sort of setting up for a big flood.
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Anything else for these three? I think I'm quite satisfied that this has some Ways and Means issues that they need to consider. So my suggestion is that we move it with a due pass to, but with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which the bill does not currently contain. And is this an amendment? Is this the original bill?
What, you have the A version. It's not the original.
We have the A version, but that's what came to us.
The committee. There is not an amendment before
this
committee.
Before the committee. Okay. Representative Berger,
yes.
Your thoughts? Or your
are
motion?
You, are you ready for
I'm
a
ready
motion?
I'm
okay.
Ready.
Let me, Paul, correct me to get it right. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2653A to the floor with a due pass recommendation and request a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Yes, you've got it. Representative Berger moves House Bill 2653 to the floor as amended or engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the request of a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion. Is there any objection to the motion? No objection. Motion carries. Bill goes to the Ways and Means, and with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2653 and open the work session on Senate Bill 954. Where are we on this one? Okay. Paperwork is coming.
That's right. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Senate Bill 954 changes the date on which the Department of Revenue would pay a percentage of the monies in the County Assessment Funding Assistance Account, or CAFA account, to counties. It changes the deadline from the 25th of the month following the close of the fiscal quarter to the 28th day of the month following the close of the quarter. There's just some...
Excuse me a moment. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 954. Now go ahead.
Okay. And the bill also removes the word shall and changes it to may not, but this does not change the meaning. It's just a modernization of language. The measure also changes the deadline by which the county treasurer must pay over the monies in the fund to the state treasurer from the 10th day of the month, following the last day of the quarter, to the 10th working day of the month. So both deadlines are moved forward a little bit in this measure. And it, there is a no revenue impact statement. There's a statement of no revenue impact, and there's a statement of no fiscal impact.
Those are on the Senate side.
Correct.
Yes, correct. So who wants to be heard on this bill?
I think Mr. Phillips is in on his day off.
No, that was Friday.
We didn't hear anything. Oh, yeah. So we're so glad he's here.
Ah, yes.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. My name is Lori Steele. I'm the Marion County Treasurer, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers. We ask that you consider Senate Bill 954 because of the impacts that the current language and statutes have on county treasurers around the state. Currently, we have 10 working days after the last quarter to transfer money over to the state treasurer's office. And because of weekends and holidays, there are sometimes during the year when this only allows us five actual working days to not only close out our last month, but also reconcile our bank statements, distribute taxes, and all of those things that have to be done before we can actually turn this money over to the state. An example is in this coming July that we're going to have. The quarter ends June 30th. July 1st is a Friday. The 4th is a Monday, which is a holiday. We also have to submit this information in 24 hours prior to the deadline, which would mean we would have to submit this information on Friday, July 8th to the state, which gives us 5 days to accomplish this work. It's oftentimes not possible to get all the numbers that we need in, so we have to do a lot of work to do amendments after the fact. And if by changing the date to the 10th working day, or the 10th working day rather than the 10th calendar day, it would be more in line with the tax requirements that we have to meet as well. Do you have any questions?
Basically a timing issue. Please,
yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. Ann Hannes, with the Association of Oregon Counties, Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, and members of the committee. This is just a common sense business operating measure, and we hope that you'll support the bill, and AOC does support it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Phillips?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue, and I concur.
Any questions for the panel? Anyone else like to be heard on this bill? I don't see any. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 954. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I move Senate Bill 954 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 954 to the floor with a due pass. Any discussion? Any objections to the motion?
No.
We have a quorum. 1, 2, 3, 4. Right? We do? All right.
No, and I'm not suggesting it go on the consent calendar.
Oh, you anticipated my question.
It's okay.
All right. There's no objection to the motion, but there is an objection to putting it on the consent calendar.
I'd be happy to discuss it if that's what you'd like. I will carry the measure, Mr. Chair.
Representative, with a motion carries, Representative Berger will carry. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 954. Paul, have we exhausted our agenda? We have. All right. With that, the committee is adjourned.